Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm your host, Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal, and it brings me great joy to tell you all that our 52nd issue is mailing to all of our subscribers right now, including our digital subscribers and our print subscribers from around the world. If you want to finally join us, if you want to finally support what we are all about and do the thing that helps power this podcast and all the other podcasts and videos we put out, just go to fretboardjournal.com and click on that subscribe button, and we will start you off with issue 52 if you so desire. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to someone who has appeared in previous issues of the Fretboard Journal, Allison Brown, one of the great bluegrass banjo players alive today. Her story is like none other. Harvard grad left Wall Street to focus on bluegrass and banjo playing and has had an incredible career. We talk about a whole bunch of different things during this conversation. She has a new album out called On Banjo, which features collaborations with everyone from Stuart Duncan, her old childhood friend, to the Kronos Quartet. We talk about her new online banjo lessons that are coming down the pike. We also talk about running a record label in 2023. Allison and her husband run Compass Records, and so much more. I feel like we've barely scratched the surface talking to Allison, but we will have her back on the show. We also, of course, talk about banjos, and there's a segue. Well, our podcast this week is sponsored by Deering Banjos once again. We talk about Allison's Deering Banjo on this very podcast, but the cool thing about Deering is they have a banjo for pretty much every price point, including those of you who are just trying to start out. And it's simply put, it's one of the great American instrument brands. You should check out what they're up to. Tell them the Fretboard Journal podcast sent you. If anybody takes up the banjo, because I've been encouraging you, please drop me a line to podcast@fretboardjournal.com. I love hearing from our listeners. We are also brought to you by Peghead Nation. You can get your first month free or $20 off of any annual subscription with the promo code Fretboard when you check out. Yes, they have banjo lessons. They also have mandolin, fiddle, guitar, and all points in between. Some of my favorite people, including many former Fretboard Journal subjects, are teachers at Peghead Nation. Check out what they are up to. String Joy Strings is sponsoring the podcast once again. You can get 10% off of your first order at stringjoy.com by using the promo code Fretboard. A ton of players in the know are using String Joy Strings right now. They're made down in Nashville, Tennessee. You should check them out. Again, use the promo code Fretboard when you do. Isotope is once again sponsoring the podcast alongside Native Instruments. Their Summer of Sound is here. This is kind of a one-of-a-kind sale where basically everything is 50% off, including many of their best-loved products like Isotope RX Standard and Music Production Suite 5.2. I'll include a link in the show notes so you can see what the heck I'm talking about, but great products for anyone out there who maybe doing some audio engineering, maybe doing some recording, maybe trying to clean up old recordings from your past. The last plug I want to give is just to our very own Chicago Fretboard Summit, taking place August 24th to 26th, 2023 at the Old Town School of Folk Music. This is turning into the most incredible open to the public guitar gathering, industry gathering that you all can be a part of. If you've ever listened to this podcast or went to a guitar store and daydreamed about meeting the people behind Collings Guitars or Bob Taylor from Taylor Guitars or meeting guitar heroes like Bill Frisell or Tommy Emmanuel, that is all happening in Chicago in this one weekend, August 24th to 26th. We have a ton of other surprises. We have a 50 exhibitor luthery show with luthiers coming from literally around the world. We have music workshops. We have instruction. We have a ton of panels and interviews and live podcast tapings going on. It's kind of a three-ring circus of guitar geekdom, and it all takes place August 24th to 26th, and it's just for people attending the Fretboard Summit. So go to fretboardsummit.org. We still have a very limited amount of three-day passes left. Nab your ticket. You're going to be able to go to everything I just described and a lot more, and it's truly a one-of-a-kind hang. So many of the people who went last year immediately renewed and got passes for this year, which was great to see. Once you attend, you will understand why this is such a special gathering. It's unlike any other guitar show or festival you've ever been to, and I hope to see some of you there. And now, without further ado, here is my chat with Allison Brown. I love talking to her. I love this conversation. I hope you do as well.
Allison, thanks for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast. My pleasure, completely. I'm a fan.
We've been emailing back and forth for a while. It's finally happening. You have a new record out called On Banjo, and I'd like to hear just the origin story of that record and how it came to be.
Well, like many records, it just came out of writing music and wanting to put that music out there, whatever out there means in 2023. But this record, unlike my last record, which was really focused on taking familiar melodies and helping people to become acquainted with what is so special about three-finger style banjo and how the melody is incorporated into like the roll pattern sometimes when you play Scruggs style. So that was a completely different pursuit, trying to show the lyrical side of the banjo through doing some cover tunes. This record was really just exploring tunes that I'd been writing. And so in some way, it's kind of like a full circle to my first record that David Grisman produced that came out in the early 90s, Simple Pleasures, which was also all original music, you know. So that was it. I mean, I have still not gotten tired of trying to find new melodies on the banjo, and that's really what this record is about.
And you have some just incredible collaborators and guests on it.
Thank you. I think they're incredible. I was delighted to play with some of the women that I think are just like the greatest female instrumentalists that have ever existed. So that was a huge honor.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's quite a breadth of, you know, traditional roots musicians. Steve Martin, obviously a great bluegrass player. Mm-hmm. The Kronos Quartet. I mean, were all these done in person?
No, they would have been if that pandemic thing hadn't happened. It was intended to, like the Kronos track. I met those guys at the Fresh Grass Festival in North Adams, Massachusetts, the fall before. And I was like, you know, they were working on their Pete Seeger record at the studio that was adjacent to Porches, which is the boutique hotel where all the artists stay.
Okay.
And so since they were working on a record that was kind of like revolved around a banjo player, I got up the nerve to ask them if they would consider recording with another banjo player. And fortunately, they said yes. So I was planning to fly out to California and record with them, and the stars didn't align for that and so many other things in 2020. So we did that one virtually. They recorded their track at Luke Skywalker Sound in Marin, and I did mine at Nashville.
I was going to ask you about that track, and now I know it's named after a hotel.
Yes, exactly. It seemed apropos, and it seemed to fit the vibe of the tune too, which to me is kind of like if Stephen Foster had written a string quartet, man, it kind of might have sounded a little like that, you know?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. That now that you mention it, are you writing new material on the banjo all the time?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always thinking about that. I'm always just trying to find the next thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that doesn't mean that I always come up with something all the time, but I'm always pursuing it, you know, mm-hmm. always looking.
Do you have a process, like when you pick up the instrument, like to get to the composing mode?
That's a really good question too. No, not really. I find sometimes, you know, when you pick up the banjo at sound check, just because it sounds different every day, a little different, you know, because you're in a different room, sometimes you'll get an idea just from that, you know, just like
the imperfections of the constantly changing banjo.
Well, there's that. Yeah, or more just like, you know, the room is giving you something different, or the thermometers are giving you something different. And so it makes you hear the instrument in a different way. And sometimes you get an idea that way. And, you know, kind of related to that is just being at home and picking up a different banjo than the one I'm usually playing. I've got John Hartford's prototype Deering low banjo right next to my, you know, desk in my little banjo room, mm-hmm. my little banjo closet. And so there's always a melody in that banjo. That's crazy. I think John just left a few behind for whoever might discover them after he was gone. So actually that's where a lot of the Porches melody came from, was John's banjo that he left behind for me. So I thank him. So, you know, it's just, I think it's a matter of having the mental space to really hear what the banjo is saying. And sometimes if it's a day where I've been just like crunching numbers or just doing a lot of Compass Records work, my mind isn't tuned into that as much as if it's a day where there's like a Sunday or a Saturday where there's just all this space yawning in front of you and you can just enjoy being in the moment more.
Yeah. I want to ask you about Compass, but before I get to that, I think half the people listening to this probably were just like, what is a low banjo? So can you just explain what John Hartford did? And I know it's on your Deering model as well now.
Yeah, of course. You know, it's not something I was aware of as an option when I started playing banjo either. Essentially, a low banjo is just a banjo. It refers to the gauges of the strings. So John had this trick, well, not trick, great idea, to use heavier gauge strings on a G banjo so that he could tune to an open E chord, essentially just like down a step and a half from where a G, you know, like the Earl Scruggs had his banjo tune in G or G sharp, he would tune his banjo in E. So he could still play all the open rolls, but he could accompany his baritone vocals more easily and still get that open sound of the banjo. Otherwise, he would have been having to play out of closed positions that don't ring as nicely. So it's all just in the gauges. But the Julia Bell banjo, you're right, is one that I developed with Deering to tribute John, really. And we dug through archives of John's artwork, courtesy of his daughter, Katie. And I found some sketches of his that I really liked. And we incorporated those into the inlay work on the fingerboard. And so when I play that banjo, I hear John's voice in it, but I also get to see his beautiful art. And he was a fine artist. He studied art, actually went to art school. So yeah. He was a polymath for sure.
He was. And is the banjo constructed any differently to accommodate this tension or anything? No.
No, it isn't. And once in a while, you know, if my other banjos in the shop or whatever, I just throw some, you know, lighter gauge strings on the Julia Bell and play it like a, just in key of G. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess you could really turn any banjo into a low banjo by just changing the gauges of the strings.
Do you find, he was obviously doing that because of his voice, but do you find that to be a little easier for composing than a high strung banjo?
Well, it's kind of like the question you asked me a minute ago. It's like if you get a different voice out of the instrument, it makes you hear it a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. So when you pick up a low banjo, it has more resonance because the strings are vibrating differently because they're tuned lower, you know, less of that high ping and more just like warm resonance. And that always makes you, you know, think of different ideas too.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful tool to have. It's a great additional voice. You know, I think as a banjo player, I'm always thinking about what other voices can I have with this instrument? Sure. And that is a great one. I love that one.
Was there anyone that you really wanted to work with for on banjo that it just like the timing didn't work out and you got to save it for a future project?
Not really. You know, I have an idea for a collaboration with Nora Jones.
Oh, wow.
In retrospect, you know, I don't think that would have fit this project, but it's something that I still want to do. Really, the tunes that I wrote with specific people in mind, I was able to get all those to happen. So I was really happy about that. I think the pandemic created opportunities as much as it took them away, and almost maybe more in some ways, because since nobody could go anywhere, yeah, in a way, you could collaborate with anybody. You know, it wasn't an issue of, can I get this person who's down in Rio to come to Nashville? I don't know, that would cost a lot for a banjo record budget.
Yeah. So it was the great equalizer.
In some way, yes, yeah, we all suffered through it too, but it's nice to be on the other side of it.
Yeah.
Somewhat, I guess.
Yeah, right. Hopefully. One of the people you worked with was Sierra Hull, one of the most dynamic singer-songwriters, mandolin players alive today. I was thinking about like what Billy Strings is doing for acoustic guitar right now. Who is the banjo equivalent? Like, who do you seek on the horizon as like, oh, this young person is going to take the banjo to the next level?
Oh, that is a really good question. I mean, I obviously Noam Pikelny is just, yeah, such a master. Actually, I've been watching his Artist Works class as I've been thinking about my own. And it's like, okay, well, there's plenty of stuff in there to keep me busy as a banjo player. He's truly amazing. I'm trying to think of the generation, you know, coming up after Noam. I really like Max Allard's playing. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
I am familiar with him a little bit, but not enough. Yeah, his name has, yeah, come up a few times.
He's a great player. I'm trying to think of who else. There's some women on the horizon. I can't think of her last name. Megan, a banjo player. I could find it, her name. Mendehall, I think, is her last name. She's doing great on the banjo. And Nikolai Margulis, I think, is how you say his last name. I think he's maybe just going to turn 16 this summer. He's playing some great banjo too. He's a real old soul. He started banjo in the classic style, taking lessons from Clark Buehling, and then got into three finger stuff and was taking some lessons from Kristen Scott Benson. And then his mom brought him to Nashville so he could have, you know, just like one-on-one lessons with a couple other banjo players. And so that's how I met Nikolai. And he's the same age as my son, only my son won't touch a banjo for $20 or, you know. And so, I mean, I really enjoy Nikolai. He's got a really bright future with the banjo, I'm sure. He's a wonderful person, too.
What is it about? Why aren't there more women playing banjo? I mean, we've got Abigail Washburn, we've got you, we've got a few, but what is that all about? I imagine all the folks interested in the banjo end up finding you because you're sort of the legend, whether you want to be or not.
Well, that's just so sweet of you to say. I don't know. That's something that I've spent a career thinking about and wondering about, because there's no reason that should be the case. So I think maybe it's marketing. I don't know. Because, I mean, truly, the banjo was a ladies' instrument at the end of the 1800s. It was the instrument of choice for demure young women to play in their parlors in the Northeast, mostly, you know, with their legs crossed just so, because you could hold the banjo with your legs crossed in a very modest pose. And if you dig back through the Library of Congress or just even go online, you can find so many gorgeous photos of women from that period, like the 1880s through, you know, the turn of the century, playing banjos. So I'm like, well, what actually did happen? How did women's voices become so disenfranchised in the instrument? And I don't know the answer to that. I think, you know, that like obviously the next big moment for the banjo was bluegrass music. I mean, from the classic repertoire, the banjo was there at the birth of jazz and then was kind of replaced by the guitar. And then it was in old time music, but it was bluegrass music that was the next big, you know, kind of international look at the banjo. And bluegrass music was, you know, all the original architects are all men. It's the founding fathers of bluegrass. And so if that's the face on the instrument, I could see why women would feel that they don't have a place in that music, or particularly with that instrument that's considered to be the most macho instrument in a bluegrass band. That kind of cracks me up, but really, you know, it's the loudest one. It's probably the heaviest one. I don't know. It's probably as heavy as a bass. It's so heavy. So I could see why women might be put off. But I think there's also this idea that being able to see someone who looks like you do that thing that you're interested in doing is really valuable. And so I think if they're, you know, to the extent that there have been so few women role models in bluegrass music, especially if you look back 60 years, it kind of explains why there would be not very many women taking it up. It's like, I don't look like that person, so I can't really see myself doing it. And to me, that's one of the reasons why I think bluegrass is at such a great inflection point, because women have really reached a tipping point, not only as performers in this genre, playing at the highest levels. You mentioned Sierra Hall. There's no better mandolin player ever anywhere. I mean, she's amazing. She blows me away. Molly Tuttle, same thing. Just, I think she's as great a guitar player as Billy Strings. So it's the first time really that we've had women that can play, you know, no question on par with the guys. So that's going to take this music in some great places, because not only are they, you know, virtuosos at the same level as any man that's ever played, I think that female voices are more, they're a better entry point for people that aren't accustomed to this music than perhaps a high lonesome, you know, male voice singing in the Bill Monroe style would be. So I think that's going to open the door to this music for a lot of people that are still on the outside.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem like, and maybe your friends at Deering will know more than, I'm sure they know more than I do about who's buying these instruments, but it seems like maybe in the world of old time music, like we have Nora Brown, I see a lot more women taking a banjo there than they are in the bluegrass realm. And I guess it might just be because it's intimidating and that there aren't enough women to start with in it.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know. It needs to change. And it's has changed a lot. I mean, when I was learning to play, I don't think that there were any women playing banjo on like a national level. There was Lauren Seepy was playing banjo with the Lost Highway, which was kind of a local band in Southern California. And she was really good, but I think maybe she was the only other female player I'd seen. I think Louisa Branscombe might have been playing banjo with Boot Hill. I'm not sure that I ever saw her do that, though. So I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. There's absolutely no reason for it. The banjo has a deep female history. We just need to get back to that place again. But we've got Kristen Scott Benson and Gina Furtado and Tabitha Benedict, right? She's doing some great banjo playing. So yeah. I just rattled off three names. Mm-hmm. And that wouldn't have been possible 30 years ago.
I know we've interviewed you and did a whole feature on you in the magazine, but what was the tipping point for you? Like, what made you take up banjo?
Oh, like so many of us of my generation and probably later generations too, it was hearing Earl Scruggs.
Yeah,
it's just that sound was just magic. You know, it was the siren call of the South. I don't know. It really spoke to me. And I was, you know, just like, whatever, 10 years old living in, then we lived in Connecticut. My family moved to Southern California and I thought, well, I'll never hear any banjo music ever again. And how I just was so surprised to find the San Diego Bluegrass Club and all this bluegrass music out in Southern California. Of course, it was more open-minded than it would have been in Appalachia.
Yeah.
But I think that in retrospect, that probably was a good thing as kind of an outlier female banjo player. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I got more encouragement or certainly less obstacles put in my way as a female player out west than I would have in the South.
Yeah. And you were in San Diego. So was like all those legendary venues like the Ash Grove and the Ice House, were those still in business?
Yeah, I can't believe that I got to experience like the end of that kind of golden age of folk music in the Los Angeles area. But I used to take the train up to L.A. and I played with Stuart Duncan, and his dad was a retired Marine. And so he kind of devoted himself to taking Stuart around to gigs and festivals and stuff. So they'd pick me up at the train station and we go play, yeah, like the Troubadour and the Ice House, Palomino Club, Banjo Cafe, of course, McCabe's.
Sure.
And, you know, back in the day when they would have, you know, bluegrass bands at the Steak and Ale, you know, there'd be like bands doing residencies at clubs like that. And it was great to get to see the end of that era. I never played at the Ash Grove, but those other legendary clubs I got to experience. I'm so fortunate.
Can you remember any of the concerts you saw at any of these places that just blew you away?
Well, I remember seeing Byron Berline in Sundance with a 19-year-old Vince Gill record a live record at McCabe's. I know the first track is Freewheel, and I still love that song. I think it was just Byron Berline in Sundance live at McCabe's. Maybe it's on Spotify. But yeah, I met Vince when he was 19 years old, and he seemed so old to me at the time, which is so funny. He reminded me of that the other day, that I've known him since he was 19.
Yeah.
Which is remarkable, but he's obviously just an incredible human as well as an amazing artist.
And you mentioned Stuart, he's on the new record. You guys go back to your early, it's amazing that you are still professional musicians even.
No, I know. I feel the same way. I mean, Stuart was always, you know, 10 leagues ahead of me, and he will always be at least 10 leagues ahead of me. But yeah, when I met Stuart, he was 10 and he was playing in a band called the Pendleton Pickers, which was an all kid band. And they'd just gotten back from playing at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville. I think they'd won, you know, some local radio contest or something, but they were great. And Stuart was like amazing. He was just like this, you know, I don't know what he was like in my mind. He's like 4.5 feet tall, just wearing out Paul Warren's fiddle solo on Earl's Breakdown. Like, who is this guy? He was so amazing. And his dad, you know, kind of cajoled him into playing with me, even though I was definitely not worthy at that time. And I'm sure he thought I had cooties, which was a thing people said back then. I can't even think of the last time I've said that word. So, you know, getting to have like a fellow journeyman as a, you know, whatever, like a young teen in Southern California, mm-hmm. somebody to geek out with about like Boone Creek and, you know, whatever, just, you know, to watch John Hickman's Hands and sit at the festivals and next to somebody else who was like really staring at like exactly what J.D. Crowe was doing. It was just a real gift to get to share that time with him. And it's amazing still to be able to, you know, talk about those times with Stuart and then play music with him too. I don't think there's ever been like a better person to pick up the violin or the fiddle or whatever you want to call I remember his mom saying to me one day, you know, it was after we'd seen Jim and Jesse play at Norco, which was the big bluegrass festival in Southern California. And she said, I wonder if Stewart will ever be as good as Joe Meadows, who was the guy playing with Jim and Jesse. He was a great fiddle player. And she would be smiling now to look at how much ground he's covered. He's a truly remarkable musician.
Yeah. That is so cool. Did you do any of the like stereotypical Southern California kid stuff? Were you also surfing while you're obsessing over bluegrass or any of that?
Yeah, I did a little bit of surfing, not too successfully. A little bit of that, you know, hanging out at the beach. I did go to a high school where people were either surfers or surfer chicks, but I am not somewhat embarrassed to say that I wore like Western shirts to school because that's what bluegrass musicians wore in Southern California. It was like country and Western. So you wore Western shirts and big belt buckles and carried my pictures of, you know, Tony Trischka and Alan Mundy in my binder. So
that's incredible.
I was a bit of a pariah.
Yeah. Was there anyone at your school that could relate or that you turned on to bluegrass music, or was this just like a secret life you led and you had friends like Stewart scattered around the state?
Yeah, it was maybe not so secret of a life, but I certainly was kind of a party of one.
Okay.
At high school as a banjo player, definitely. But that's why it was so wonderful to have Stewart, you know, to be able to pal around with and, you know, go out on weekends and hang out with his family and do the bluegrass thing and then come back to school and just, you know, kind of like be a little school nerd during the week and do that.
And as is often mentioned, you were a school nerd. You actually got to the highest levels of higher education before focusing on banjo.
Well, I was always a very dedicated student. And like I probably mentioned at the beginning, my parents did not envision banjo playing as a career path for me. Sure. And they were really hoping for a doctor because there wasn't one in the family. And instead, they got an MBA. But yeah, I really had my sights set on going to Harvard. And once I'd scoped out the back pages of Bluegrass Unlimited magazine and looked at the listings of bluegrass clubs in the different states, I was like, well, you know, clearly Cambridge has New Haven beat. So and that was, you know, that turned out to be just a great place for me. I mean, the academic part was wonderful and the community was wonderful, but the musical riches of Boston, you know, even in the 80s when I was at Harvard, I still think it's one of the best markets, if not the best, for folk music in the United States. And my first day, you know, my mom dropped me off at my dorm and I walked through Harvard Yard and there was the Knoxville Grass playing at Payne Hall, which was one of the concert halls at Harvard. And I couldn't believe it because I'd only ever read about them in Bluegrass Unlimited magazine. And I had just walked to a bluegrass show. I was so happy. And the first person I met was, Stan Zadonik, you know, running the BBU, the Boston Bluegrass Union. And he's still a pillar of the bluegrass community. And I actually remember my mom saying to him, well, keep an eye on her, which is so funny. Aww. I mean, it's a magical thing really to be in a genre that's, has room in it for you, no matter what age you are. I mean, you can come into this music like I did at 10. And then at my age now, which is many, many years later, you know, I get to have relationships with people that I've known at different points throughout my life and still feel that, you know, it's as welcoming of me as it has ever been at any age, you know, and I don't think that that's true in pop music. You know, I think you can age out of that, but you don't age out in bluegrass music. And I think that's one of the strengths of our community and one of the most beautiful things about it, really.
Yeah. I mean, that is the magical thing about attending a real bluegrass festival is you'll see a 10-year-old alongside an 80-year-old and they're just jamming on the same tune. They all know them. So,
Well, yep. And I've been in those jam sessions at every age and it's a great unifier and it's a great builder of community. And I think that's something that we could all use.
Yeah. When you applied to Harvard, did you have to write an essay and did it include any reference to the banjo or bluegrass?
Oh, well, what do you think?
I want to know.
Yeah. Well, of course. I mean, you know, it's all marketing. I mean, you have to have a hook. That was my hook. And I think that I wrote some kind of creative writing piece, you know, like this imagined, you know, kind of journey in a van to bluegrass festivals. And it was sort of definitely based on real life experience because Stewart Stuart's dad had taken Stuart and me on a trip back east, quote unquote, back east to do the festivals when I think the summer that I turned 16. And so it was the first chance I'd had to really experience bluegrass in the context of the culture that it came out of, you know, Southern culture and Southern bluegrass festivals. I'd never been in the South.
Yeah.
And that just, it still is endlessly fascinating to me, the South and the music that's come out of the South and, you know, just the racial issues and the racial baggage and how all that's played forward into modern times. And the instrument that I play, which is, you know, really at the center of so much of that. It's endlessly fascinating to me. So yes, the banjo was at, it was at the center of my Harvard application. And I guess he needed a banjo player. I don't know. I also had, Stuart and I had played on the Grand Ole Opry that summer that we did that trip. And so I think I included a cassette tape of our performance as well.
That's a good move for those, that application jury or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty sure that at least it stood out on some level. For better or for worse, I guess it worked.
Yeah, for sure. So you and your husband run Compass Records. How has that been, especially through the pandemic?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, it's running an independent label in the digital music era. It's challenging. I think running any label in this era is challenging, because the rules have shifted as distribution platforms have broadened, you know. Mm-hmm. When we started the company, we actually distributed our music through a network of regional distribution companies. It was before computerization of inventory was a commonplace at most retail accounts.
Yeah.
So you could ship records to accounts, get paid net 30, and a lot of times they didn't even know what they had because they didn't have computerized inventory. So there's probably boxes of your product laying around they didn't even know that they had that hadn't sold. So then there was the change to, you know, 100% consignment and computerization of inventory, and that really tightened things up. And then, you know, 2004 or early 2000, Steve Jobs decided that an album was actually worth $9.99 and should only have 10 tracks on it. So that changed everybody's thinking. And we're like, well, how are we going to deal with this now that it's a download and physical? And then streaming really just made that look like a cakewalk. And it really is challenging existing in physical space like we do. All of our records are released in physical format, CD always, and then vinyl increasingly more, and digital across all the DSPs. So it's challenging because you're carrying the cost of inventory and then you're earning at streaming rates too. So it's challenging, but we're always trying to see around the corner. We're always trying to figure out how we can be as smart as possible, mm-hmm. marketing our music and supporting our artists. And we're still, even after almost 30 years of doing it, we're still as passionate as we were at the beginning to find the best answers to these questions and helping to play this music forward so that it's, you know, there for future generations to discover in its best form, you know, high production quality and production values and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, I think most of us can wrap our heads around this on the artist level, but on the label level, are there any new avenues for you to make money and stay profitable that didn't exist? I mean, we keep hearing about stuff that's going away because of technology. Are there new mm-hmm. opportunities?
Well, new opportunities. I think that broadcast royalties are a potential opportunity. And, you know, copyright law is so nuanced in the United States and it's so boring that I don't want your listeners to like turn the podcast off. But essentially, there's been a loophole in U.S. copyright law since the very beginning with regard to terrestrial radio airplay. That's AM, FM radio. That the master owner, there's two sides to every copyright. If you take a song like Aretha Franklin's Respect, there's the publishers of the song Respect, which anyone could record. And then there's Aretha's unique recording of that song. And our copyright law allows for the publisher to earn broadcast royalties every time that song's played on the radio. But Aretha has never earned any royalties as the artist and the master. The people who created that unique recording have never earned any money for that airplay. So it's not fair. The argument has always been that they got free promotion, which doesn't really hold water because most AM/FM radio airplay is catalog music that doesn't need promotion. It's just a loophole. And the United States is one of only, I think, four countries in the world that don't pay the master owners for broadcast or broadcast royalty. And the other three being China, North Korea, and Iran. So it's like,
we're in good company.
Embarrassing. And it's something that's long overdue to be changed. And there's the American Music Fairness Act, which is the current legislation that's trying to correct that inequity. All that to say that when satellite radio came online, the rules didn't apply the same way. So on satellite radio airplay, the master owner and the publisher both get a royalty, which is the way it should be. And that model has proven to work because it's working with satellite radio. Mm-hmm. So I think that as that gets corrected, hopefully as quickly as possible. I mean, people have been working on it since Frank Sinatra founded Reprise in the 60s. It's been ongoing that long that people have been trying to correct this. And I think that when that gets corrected, that will be some extra margin for labels that's well-deserved. I mean, there's really just not an argument for that to continue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I noticed your music just when I was searching a week ago, preparing for this, like one of the first four or five links is the Bandcamp page, which usually I think people think of Bandcamp as for artists who are self-releasing records. Mm-hmm. Like as a label, is Bandcamp beneficial to you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, just any way that you, there's such a proliferation of channels to reach the audience now compared to how it used to be. It used to be that, you know, there were a few major gatekeepers, and if you could get through those gatekeepers, you could reach the audience. So, for example, if you got a piece in the New York Times or if you got a piece on CBS Sunday Morning, you would ship thousands of records on the back of press like that because people just weren't, their attention wasn't as fragmented. But now it's, you know, there's just so many channels and each one of them has less weight. So even if you get somebody's review in the New York Times, you don't see nearly the impact, just a fraction of the impact that you used to see. So we're always looking for every possible channel to get the word out about somebody's release. And there are some fans that focus on Bandcamp. So yes, as a label, we found that to be, especially for artists in certain genres, just a really great way to get the word out. And that's what we're trying to do, you know, spread the good word.
Yeah. I've seen many emails from you in a wide variety of capacities here at the Fretboard Journal. Just how many hats do you wear? Like what is your official title right now? And what's a typical day look like for you?
Oh, well, there is no typical day. I wear a lot of hats, but I use co-founder as my title most often, probably. And, you know, Gary and I started the label on the kitchen table. And so we literally grew it up from a seed. And so at some point we were both, you know, packing boxes to ship records to Tower Records and, you know, making all the publicity calls and doing all that stuff. So over time, as there's a need, I can kind of jump in a lot of different areas. So, although there are certain things that I have never done, especially on the digital side, since a lot of that has come on so much later, you know. But yes, I wear a lot of hats. I still find myself doing a lot of writing for the label just because of that old college education. You know, I can hammer out copy. It's me. Yeah. It's between me and the chatbot. We haven't gotten to the chatbots yet, but I can definitely
say, it's on its way. You might be rendered obsolete. I know.
I might be. Well,
people keep talking about it.
I'd like to hear a chatbot play the banjo.
Don't mention that. It'll happen.
I know, but I want to hear it. Could be illuminating in some way. I don't know. Well, it could be.
Do you focus much on it? Is it part of your job finding the next new releases and the next artists?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. Gary, that tends to be more in his wheelhouse than mine. But we get a lot of pitches, and he's on the front lines doing the A&R stuff more than I am. But I get a lot of calls and things sent too, especially in the bluegrass space, because I wave the bluegrass flag for the label. And although it's just one of the many things that we do and have done, you know, because of me, there are certain people that think of us as a bluegrass label. So we get a lot of bluegrass pitches, and that's right in my wheelhouse. So I tend to, you know, always have my eyes on the horizon for that.
How many, just broadly speaking, how often do you put out a record where it's like you had never seen them at a festival, you had never heard of them, they just sent you a record or a recording that blew you away? Has that happened?
I don't know if that has ever happened quite, okay. Because there's always, you know, some degree of separation, because this community is so intertwined.
Yeah.
That I don't think that we've ever signed anybody just like completely from the void, where there was no other connectivity to that artist, which is not to say that, you know, things don't come to us all different ways. You know, sure. We will get unsolicited pitches that we listen to and really like, but then it's never somebody that nobody that we know doesn't know. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You quickly mentioned when you were talking about Gnome Artist Works, and that he's got a banjo instruction class, but you have a banjo instruction class coming out, right?
Yes, I do. This summer, I'm really excited about it.
Tell us about it.
Well, you know, I gave a lot of thought to what direction to take with the course. And Artist Works is interesting because rather than being like focusing on a specific topic within your instrument, you take your subscribers from soup to nuts. So it's all the way from like, how do you hold a banjo to like the most advanced material. And I really gave a lot of thought to where to focus my energy in that course. And I landed on, you know, really trying to make this instrument as accessible as I could for people, either just starting out or, you know, beginners that are trying to transcend to become intermediate players that can sit down in a jam session, feel comfortable, feel willing to like jump in there, take a chance, make up their own solo on the spot. And I really tried to break down that wall that I think a lot of banjo players encounter, which is, how do you weave a melody into a role and how do I make up my own solo? You know, I know how to do the thing that I learned from the tab, but how do I play a song that I'm just hearing for the first time, you know, that's in the bluegrass canon? So I spent some time really like looking at the patterns of like the chord patterns of things and, you know, breaking down certain licks and trying to think about the roles, the Scruggs roles in terms of vocabulary, the way you would learn a foreign language. Like, this role is a certain piece of vocabulary that gets you to this place melodically as opposed to this one. So yeah, I'd say it's definitely more oriented at this point towards like the beginner intermediate range. But the other thing about these courses is that they're living documents. So I've got plenty of places that I want to take that. I just wanted to make sure that people are started off with a really solid foundation, and most importantly, are making music as fast as possible on the banjo and not letting like the three finger thing, which can be really mathematical because you're like playing three against two all the time. Like, how do you get that not to be a barrier to people's enjoyment of the instrument?
Yeah. I mean, it's super rare for a world-class musician of any instrument to be teaching like kind of entry-level beginner courses. You know, that's like getting a driving lesson from Mario Andretti or something. Is it fun for you to kind of try to channel back that beginner's mindset of like, I'm looking at this thing for the first time and trying to make music on it. How do I do it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I will say that there are a lot of great instructors on the Artist Works platform, many of whom I are among my favorite musicians that are just incredible virtuosos. And that's another thing that I love about this community is from the very beginning of my involvement in the bluegrass community, I could go up to any player who was leagues ahead of where I was, and they would always stop and show me what I was wondering about, you know, always take time to show me. And there's this great spirit of playing the tradition forward. That's another beautiful thing about our community. And I definitely have that desire too, because so many people have been so generous with me over the years. But yes, breaking it down was interesting because I had to try to remember what it was like, you know, being like a baby banjo player, wanting to like figure out a solo on the spot to roll in my sweet baby's arms. And how do you go up the neck without getting lost? And thinking about the tricks that I use to kind of figure out how to get across that boundary and have more fluency on the fingerboard. So I hope people find it illuminating. I really hope it creates more banjo players, especially of the female persuasion.
Yeah. I mean, this is one instrument where until a lot of this online teaching took over, like that Earl Scruggs book was really the thing that probably tens of thousands of banjo players all found that book, right? Like that was the thing.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. And I spent some time looking back at that book too, because my parents never wanted to invest in a copy of the book. And so they would make me Xerox, like if there was a page of tab, we would just like make a photocopy of that page. And so one of the things I love about Earl's playing is how God is really in the details. Like there's so many ways you can get, there's so many roads lead to Rome on the banjo. Like there's so many ways to play a tune Scruggs style on the banjo, but the particular order of notes and cadence of notes that he chose, it's just, that's really kind of mind blowing to get to go back and look at that. And I kind of wish I'd learned that exactly right from the get go, but maybe I appreciate it more now. Getting to go back and look at that.
Yeah, maybe the Xerox was just smudged so you could see that part.
Oh, maybe that was it. But, you know, I had this incredible honor a few weeks ago of getting to play Earl's Granada Banjo at its official installation into the Country Music Hall of Fame. And so I was like deep diving into the Scruggs book for that occasion too, because I was like, they asked if I would play Earl's Breakdown, which is my favorite Earl Scruggs tune. Well, right up there next to Sally Ann, but I know he wrote Earl's Breakdown. And so I wanted to try to learn it note for note and to play it on this Granada banjo with the Earls of Leicester. I can't believe I got to do this. It was just a real where's Waldo kind of moment. But so that kind of gave me the opportunity to really dig in and like see exactly what he was doing, at least according to the book. And it's truly remarkable. Yeah. You know, it's amazing too to see kind of the alternating role, which I really kind of was my point of entry for my students in my Artist Works class, which is the first thing my teacher taught me, which I kind of think of as more of an old time kind of like, you know, kind of like a thumb index, thumb middle. Please don't change the channel, folks. I won't say too much of a deep dive on the banjo, but this pattern that I'm sure would have been, it's kind of like Travis picking on the guitar. And just to see how related it is to the forward roll, which was the big bang for bluegrass style and Earl Scruggs style that enabled you to play much faster, but also how much Earl integrates that roll pattern into what he does. So I didn't really realize that until I started doing this deep dive for my Artist Works course and also for my, you know, playing of Earl's banjo in a somewhat legitimate fashion. So it's all fascinating stuff. It's great to look back.
I love that book that is probably at almost every used bookstore right now still has secrets to unveil onto the world. That is so cool.
Yeah, it's completely cool. I mean, there's so much magic to all of that for me.
I think guitarists, you know, we romanticize Tony Rice's Antique. We romanticize these guitars that our heroes play and you know, maybe great artists who get to play those get a little closer to that tone. Is it the same with banjos? Do you feel Earl's presence when you're playing his old instrument, and does it kind of evoke that sound?
Yes, of course. I mean, it makes the hair stand up on your arms. It's so cool. I mean, playing this banjo, it basically, I had a chance to play it a couple of years ago for a thing the Country Music Hall of Fame did as a fundraiser during the pandemic called Big Night. And I think prior to that, it had been in its case for 8 years. So like Earl's DNA is still on the neck. Like there's this wear and gooey stuff at the end of the neck. And it's like, that's Earl there. So yeah, it's completely magical, completely spiritual. You know, when you do that second to third fret slide on the third string, you know, like the Cripple Creek slide, mm-hmm. You can totally hear the bluesiness of Earl in that, on that instrument. It's such a cool thing. And I was standing backstage with Sean Camp, who was playing in Earls of Leicester when we did the Country Music Hall of Fame thing. And he was playing Leicester's guitar and I was playing Earl's banjo. So we were just like kind of holding the instruments up next to each other so that they could say hi to each other after all these years. It was like, we both had like goose flesh. It was, yeah, it is very, very magical. And I don't know, I don't think that we're really anthropomorphizing these instruments. I mean, I really think there's something to that, to the voices mm-hmm. of these instruments that gave the voice to bluegrass music. Just that unique voice is in these instruments. And it's just amazing to get to hold them and play them and hear their voices speak again after all this time.
So that brings me to my final question. When a guitarist or even a mandolin player goes to a music store and I won't even mention whatever brand, like they could grab any brand, high-end or mid-level, and one instrument might just sound profoundly better than the one right next to it at this, you know, made at the same plant, same year, whatever. Is that the same with like new banjos?
Yeah, it's all, banjos are interesting because every part's movable, or almost every part. Yeah. Unlike a guitar is like basically a piece of wood. You can't really do that much.
You don't want it to move.
But banjo players, not me, but I don't know why. I've never been a particularly great tinkerer with banjos, but most banjo players are incessant tinkerers. And when I was 14, I guess, I was playing in a band with Stuart Duncan and John Hickman. We had this gig at Magic Mountain playing at Spillikin Corners like 6 days a week, 5 hours a day. And I was playing terrible dobro, standing next to John Hickman, who was playing amazing banjo. And I watched him every day. Every day he would change his strings. He had like a ritual for changing his strings and wiping the stuff off the strings, putting them on, and then tinkering with the head and the height of the tailpiece and the tuning of the head and the placement of the bridge. And like, there's countless things that you can do to these instruments. And so, yes, you know, you can make a banjo sound one way at breakfast and another way at lunch, you know? So it's really pretty remarkable. Yes. So you absolutely, there's a huge amount of variety, even like between banjos for sure, but even within one banjo, you know, the right person's hands on that instrument can make it like night or day. It's crazy.
Who's your guy in Nashville, if you don't mind me asking, or gal? I don't know who this person is.
No, I don't actually have a, well, the person who's my next guy, banjo guy, I'm going to go up and see Charlie Cushman, because we were, obviously he plays banjo with Earls of Leicester. And so we were geeking out over Earl's banjo together. And when we played Earl's Breakdown, I like kicked it off and I passed the banjo to Earl while the curators at the museum held their collective breaths. We promised we wouldn't drop it, and we didn't drop it. And so then Charlie played solo, and then he passed it back to me, and then I played a solo. And so we both got to share geeking out over Earl's banjo. And he's like, well, come up and visit me sometime and we'll work on banjos and talk about banjos. So as soon as I get a break, that's my next stop is Charlie's shop.
All right. I love it. It's like the two people in the driveway looking at the engine in the car with the hood up, reminiscing.
So true. It's so true. I'm really looking forward to that. He's got the magic touch and such a big heart for those old banjos, and as you know, such a deep love for that, for the instrument. And it's an amazing thing. I mean, the banjo has given me friendships with people that I never would have had friendships with had I stayed in investment banking. So among the many things I'm grateful to the banjo for, that's probably at the top of the list.
I love it. Allison, thank you. Congratulations. The record sounds great. I'm sure this will be the first of many conversations. And if anyone out there obviously has questions for you that they want to do a follow-up interview or something, like, let me know. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you. And thank you for what you're doing for the music. I listen to your podcasts and I really
thank you. Thank you. Pressure's on. I appreciate it. And I love is right back at you for Compass Records, like so many great releases.
Thank you so much, Jason.
That was my conversation with Allison Brown, one of the most fascinating people in the world of fretted instruments. On Banjo, her new album is out now. Her instruction course on banjo is going to be coming fairly soon. Stay tuned for that. And thanks, as always, for tuning in to the Fretboard Journal podcast. If anyone has any feedback, shoot me a note, podcast@fretboardjournal.com. Also, don't forget to leave us a review over on Apple Podcasts.